Connecting the city and surrounding villages. You've found Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon, welcome to Flavour. Thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. I'm Matt Bentman.
And I'm Alan Alder. Ruth Reyes can't be with us today, but we do have beer, wine, coffee, pizza, kitchen gadgets and hens.
And at the end of the programme, we'll have the Cambridge food and drink news.
And what more could you ask for?
So we begin today with a new cafe that's opened up on Mill Road. It's so new it doesn't even have its sign up yet, but it is open for business and it's worth checking out. It's called Latteo, which is Italian for luthier. It's an odd choice of name for a cafe, but you'll find out why from its owner, Jonathan Wolfston.
The violin we were just listening to was a violin that I made in 2015, and it's an exact replica of a Guadagnini violin made in 1742.
The reason why we were listening to that is because this is not just any music shop. There's something very distinctive about this place in terms of its music.
The thing that makes this shop distinctive is the fact that we sell musical instruments, violins, violas, cellos, and also some Chinese instruments. And it's quite unique because we also sell fusion food, and the cafe also hosts live music.
My name is Yemi. I'm a music therapist. The piece that I was playing was improvisation. If you really want to, like, just grab a violin and practice as long as you want.
I've been making violins for about 30 years now, and most recently I spent almost a decade working at the Royal Academy of Music in London. It was when I was approached by Coco about her plans to open up a cafe selling fusion food here. I decided that I would ask her if we could partner up and I could also sell musical instruments here and we turn it into a music cafe. Basically, she gave me the confidence to actually give this a try, you know.
Is this because she's run places previously herself?
Yeah, well, Coco used to run an antique Chinese furniture shop here that was always very interesting and lovely to come in. But then she decided she didn't really want to do that anymore and she wanted to do something totally different.
I'm Coco. I'm Jonathan's business partner. My idea to create this shop is to put the East and West together. And from you coming to the shop, the first feeling is very European feel. And then you slowly walk to the end of the shop, you can see a strong Chinese culture.
She's the inspiration behind the decoration or decor in this place.
Latteo is a fashion of old and new, and where people can enjoy good music along with good food and good company.
You have a nice long shop. It just extends all the way back. There's plenty of room here for diners, for people to appreciate music, and you also have an antique section as well.
The problem we had was where do we put the grand piano? The space, even though it's 1,600 square feet, it's a bit too small to have a stage, so we decided that it should be in the middle of the cafe.
But the piano is one special gift for my daughter when she's 7 years old. But now she's in university, put that here and everyone can see that and enjoy that.
For the cafe side, the food is also very authentic, but it tends to be a fusion food. There's Chinese, English and Korean and lots of different things there, all freshly made on the day or made in front of you. And it's great for people to experience something new. I don't think Mill Road necessarily needs another cafe serving just coffee. It needs something that's very interesting for the general public, whether you play a musical instrument or not. It's just you can go, you can relax, you can listen to someone play, or if you want to buy a violin, you can buy a violin as well.
Violin and tea.
A violin and tea, exactly.
We were treated to a Chinese tea-making ceremony, demonstrated by a student in full regalia. It served as a stark contrast to my casual time-it-takes-to-boil-a-kettle-job-done routine. No. This was very specific.
I will now explain step by step the meaning of each movement. First, you can't pour hot water into the middle of the pot because Chinese saying that you will hurt the heart of the tea. Tea is our friend. So the middle is the heart. You can't use hot water to hurt it. So the first thing you need to do is from the side and slowly up. The reason why I'm pouring water out of the pot is pottery should be flourished by hot water, so I deliberately pour some water out of the pot. When I'm pouring it, it's from very high. It's saying that it's high mountain and flowing water. It's mimicking the waterfall, so it's like this. Okay, then we come to the next step, which is nodding of the phoenix. Nodding your head. 1, 2, 3. To represent your grateful for your friend's coming and your politeness to your guest. And the reason why you're doing this is because the flavor of the tea is going to change according to the depth. So you need to make the flavor of each cup similar. So it's going onwards and backwards, distributed into each cup. This movement is like an ending pose for the whole tea ceremony. It's going to pull the rest of the tea into each of the small cups. We're only for 70% of them. Why? 30% is left for the friendship. You need to use the friendship to fill the cup, to make 100% of the tea. And that's all of the steps I've done. Thank you.
This basically started with a scrap of paper and a pencil, and it started with the design. I didn't really want a traditional violin shop. I wanted something that had more elements to it. And it's not just a little boutique jam pack full with violins. I wanted sort of space as well, an open plan sort of feel, to make everyone comfortable.
And it is very comfortable. All the music that you're hearing was playing live at Lutayo. I was eating from layers of dim sum, steamed pork dumplings, that's north and south pork dumplings, where one is sweeter than the other, and the pastry is also different, with some incredible sauces.
But this red liquid here is rocket fuel. Be very careful. Would you like some water?
It might be handy.
I also tried steamed breaded sweet pork, which had the consistency of clouds, and the pork was just a lovely pulled pork. Conventional cutlery is available, but if you're a seasoned man of the world like me, you'll have no problem with real steel Korean chopsticks.
Using the index.
That's the incorrect way to hold them.
Since they've been open, Lutayo on Mill Road have had one item on their menu that's proved particularly of interest. It's called wife cake, and there's a story behind it.
传说有一对恩爱的夫妻，媳妇卖身为家翁治病，失去妻子的丈夫病了。Legend
has it that back in China,
feudal China,
a daughter-in-law offered herself for sale in return for money to cure her ill father-in-law. In a desperate attempt to redeem his spouse,
the husband used the simplest ingredients to create a gourmet cake for sale in the bazaar.
His product did pay off. With the proceeds saved, the couple was able to get back together again and lived happily ever after.
His recipe
then spread from place to place.
Place to place.
Winning the name Wife Cake.
Wife Cake.
Winning the name Wife Cake.
The character of this cake. The most important things is the crispy layers and the sweet and sticky core inside. And that's what makes this kind of cake so delicious and different from others.
That's a lot more dense than I thought it would be. It's a much thicker cake. I was thinking of something like a mille feuille, you know, very light crispy layers. But this is a solid cake and it's got a gorgeous interior as well. Sweet. I love sweet things.
There is so much music talent in Cambridge, and they're just bursting at the seams to perform or to listen to other music, that I just think this cafe is going to be a winner.
I do believe that, actually.
It's actually the students, and it's not just students, it's professionals as well. They come in here and they want to perform, and the word of mouth just gets out, and people will just want to come, bring their friends and introduce them to lovely food and lovely coffee.
Well, you have jellyfish on the menu as well.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this area of Mill Road is it's developing fast, you know. You're the latest entrant on here, and we're just seeing it's stretching further and further along. Yeah. And the Mill Road Mile is starting to be taken up with more quality establishments and more interesting things. It's grand.
But yeah, I have a great view of the comings and goings in Mill Road. I just love it. I love it here. You're not recording, are you?
No, he says.
We are Luteo, 224 Mill Road.
On the Romsey side of the beach.
Yeah, we hope to see you soon.
I stayed there for the evening because it was just so relaxing, you know? There were lots of faces looking in the front window. They're going, "Ooh, this is new." And when they came in, they were just blown away by the performances and the food. One guy said to me, "This is my new favourite place. It's so chilled." Other things on the Luteo menu include pork and pickled pak choy, which is a very famous Chinese dish, and unagi, which is great eel. So anyone who's tried eels from Ely, here's a Japanese version, and it's recommended for those who like sweet things. So that's Luteo, mixing East and West, fusion food with grand pianos, violins, cellos, and Chinese instruments like the Gaozheng Lushui, which you heard in that feature.
I'm Mandy Morton.
And I'm Nicola Robson.
And collectively we present
The Eclectic Light Show,
a monthly arts magazine featuring
the very best in
theatre, music, film, books
and celebrity interviews.
Join us on the first Sunday of every month
from 2 till 4
on community radio
in your city.
Cambridge 105.
Right, well, there's a new pizza stall on the market which is called River Kitchen, and Ruth spoke with Eleanor from the stall about pizzas.
So I'm with Eleanor of River Kitchen Pizza, and you started on the market about 3 months ago?
Yeah, it was the 4th of January. We woke up and it was very cold. We woke up rather early and just kind of looked at each other and decided it was a great idea to come in to Cambridge Market and set up a pizza bar. So here we are 3 months later and the sun is coming out, and we have lovely Will playing music. He's a busker who we've met whilst doing this, and it's slowly there's this wonderful thing happening.
Oh, that's great. Has it been good then on the market?
Yeah, we've met lots of amazing people, and what I love the most is the fact that we have regulars who come, and we have people who have sort of met one another through turning up at our stall. So it's becoming Cambridge's answer to Cheers, with a little bit of pizza thrown in there too.
What kind of pizzas do you have today? Are they the same every day?
No, they kind of differ. Like, we have three that stay the same, and then we kind of just every now and again throw something new together. So the other day I was having a little bit of an asthma attack, and I bought a lot of fresh thyme for my asthma, and then I just thought, well, actually this is a great herb that we should be really making use of. So it's the fact that what we do is we end up just adding to pizzas that we already have, and we actually make pizzas up with our customers as well. So we have a pizza that now features on our menu called the Goat Race, which was tried by a lovely customer of ours called Emma for the first time ever. And we really are just sort of playing as we go along. I feel like theatre and food are really part of one another, and there's certainly something quite theatrical about creating and playing with the customers and seeing what we can come up with. And some of them don't work. We've had We had a man who tried prawns with chorizo and mushrooms, and he liked it, but I don't think that I would necessarily put it out for anyone else. Yeah.
That's really cool. So what's the most unusual flavour combination you've had?
We've done, I think the best one was probably when we put some figs and beetroot and goat's cheese together with then some chilies and things like that. So, but we are thinking of doing breakfast pizzas as well.
That sounds amazing. What would entail in a breakfast pizza?
So I was looking at breakfast pizzas on the internet and we saw a scrambled egg pizza, which might be quite interesting. And then I thought, well, what goes with scrambled egg? And I just wanted to, like, you know, do something no one else is doing on the market. So maybe like scrambled egg and salmon, or scrambled egg and just a vegetarian option, so wild mushrooms or something like that. But then I thought, well, why not go for a sweet pizza too? Perhaps there'll be maybe a banana and chocolate something or other happening quite soon, yeah.
And what kind of base do you use? Is it just a normal flour or is it...
It's a vegan dough. So we've noticed that there are a lot of vegans in Cambridge, and we want them to come to us. So we have a vegan taster who regularly comes, and we create pizzas with him. We haven't sourced a vegan cheese yet, and we are kind of hoping to find a wheat-free option too, but as of yet we haven't found anything that works in terms of being outside. Dough's a really interesting creature to put out in the cold or the heat. It's a naughty little ingredient. You turn around and if it's too cold, it looks like it doesn't want to get out of bed in the morning. It's all sort of cracked. Or you turn around and it's grown enormously. So, finding a wheat-free option is proving to be a little bit difficult, and we want to get it right, so...
How often are you out on the market?
How often are we out? We're here 5 days. We don't come in on Thursdays, and we don't come in on Saturdays yet. We really want Saturday. But we're dotted about too. We're not any longer just in one place. We tend to be around the fountain or near the church.
Are you anywhere else out there on the market or just here?
We are open to doing kind of outdoor events and really doing people's private parties. We've recently put on our own charity ball called the Polka Dots and Feathers Ball.
Oh, wow.
And we had circus entertainers and this crazy, crazy electro swing DJ, and everyone dressed up, and we had a great time. For us, it doesn't just stop at the market, and it doesn't just stop at pizza either. Pizza's great, but it's not all we do.
Amazing. How do we get in touch then?
Okay, well, you could jump on Facebook and look at us on there. We are just down as the River Kitchen. We are on Twitter. Or you can email us, of course, theriverkitchencambridge@gmail.com. So, yes, that's where we are.
Brilliant. So have you done any cooking before, or is it just an adventure that you've started?
We cook, yeah. We started really by doing festival food for crew. I used to... provide a circus for their food whilst at Glastonbury, and then I went and did various other festivals, and then we both worked at Red Rooster last year, and then working in Cambridge doing sort of more the tourist side of things, we thought, you know what, this would maybe be a good venture, so
cool.
We just jumped in at the deep end.
Well, thank you very much for chatting with me.
Wonderful. There you go.
Yeah, thank you for coming, Ruth.
And that was Eleanor from River Kitchen. And you can find River Kitchen at Cambridge Market every day, except Thursdays and, for the moment, Saturdays. And there are some interesting ideas for pizzas there.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Still to come on Flavour today, a new Cambridge brewery, also Cambridge Hens, and Alice Archer from Cambridge Wine Merchants, who will be talking about organic and biodynamic wines. That's a lot of Cambridge.
But first, one of the, well, great pleasures in life is surely cooking good food. Yet, no matter how interesting the recipe, there are often bits in the making of it that, well, are a bit of a chore. But help is at hand. With advice on essential kitchen tools, here's Teen Roche from the Cambridge Cookery School.
Tomorrow we're on spud duty, and those knives are supposed to be as sharp as a chemistry teacher's cardigan. Do you reckon he can get us a couple of good potato peelers?
This week I'd like to talk about one of the most modest tools in the kitchen, the vegetable peeler. You know, I think it's one of those jobs that we all feel a bit sort of about. You know, if you want help in the kitchen, you say, why don't you peel the potatoes for me? People tend to get a bit disappointed. They think, oh, maybe I can help with something a bit more glamorous than that. But actually, a good peeler can really make that job so much quicker and so much better. And interestingly, people have quite strong preferences about it, I think. You know, we're looking at three of them here, and yes. They're swivel peelers, which are sort of horizontal. You've got a sort of semicircle with a horizontal blade. It's quite easy to pick it up so that the blunt side sort of faces up. And then you're standing there with your unpeeled carrot and or potato wondering why it's not working, and you have to give it a bit of a shake and start again. Mm. Maybe that's just me, but I've never really got on with them. Then there's my perhaps pet hatred, if I should use such a strong word. It's the one that's got a swivel blade set vertically, but in a kind of shield, if you like. I guess it's there to protect your fingers, but it never quite works like that. And it just makes them really inflexible somehow, and you can't quite angle it the way you want. And again, peeling becomes a bit cumbersome. And if you're peeling a carrot, you get sort of half the length off, then you have to start again. So you get these jagged edges as well, which is very unsatisfying.
I guess very stop-start as well, because it's going to be collecting all the peel as you go along.
Exactly. So that is probably the slowest out of the tools, I would say. So I would say that one we should get rid of, possibly. You know, it doesn't really, I think it's an ill-designed kitchen tool. Mm. And it's interesting when you look at any kind of utility, sometimes they're actually quite shockingly ill-designed. You just think the whole purpose is to work well, yes, and yet they don't. So my absolute favourite is the most humble one. And in fact, this one has a sort of solid plastic handle. They come in a version where the whole tool is just very lightweight stainless steel, I suppose it is, isn't it? So the whole thing is, it's like a pen. And as I say, I prefer the thing because it's very light. The whole blade swivels, not fully, but virtually, sort of almost full circle. Incredibly light, incredibly easy to use, mm-hmm, and it just gets such a good cut in and just peels. You get these lovely long, quite satisfying if you're a bit OCD perhaps, so you get these beautiful long shaved peels from carrots, and you get the best part of a whole potato off. Wonderful, and probably sets you back about a couple of pounds to perhaps a tenner at the very, very, very most. But a tool that tends to be used almost daily, lasts a really long time, goes in the dishwasher. It's brilliant.
As you say, a badly made one could almost double your peeling time.
It could. Yeah. And it just becomes annoying, you know. And I think when we've talked about tools in the past, it really can make or break how you feel about your success in the kitchen. Because if you're looking at something burnt, or you're annoyed because something took you much longer. Mm. And often I think people assume it's their own ineptitude, but often it's not. It's actually just using the wrong tool.
Are there also peelers which serve, say, like a dual function, where you have some peelers that can also core a fruit or a vegetable?
Yeah, I mean, the core, yes, there are, absolutely. And the corer are brilliant, of course, particularly for hard things like apples. I dare say with some other fruits like pears and so on, if they're ripe, you could maybe sort of get around it other ways. But they are brilliant, very satisfying. Get that inserted and then it kind of comes out like a big plug and you have this beautiful, beautiful hole. I quite like baked apples in the winter.
Oh, yes.
So I think, you know, if you've got a nice, clean, cylindrical incision there, and then you just fill that with a bit of butter and a bit of brown sugar, perhaps. That's wonderful.
So a peeler and a corer at the same time.
Yes.
In recent years, I've become increasingly wary of anything that claims to do two jobs out of one device. Mm. But this is one that is actually justified.
Yeah, it does. I think it does do two jobs, yes. Absolutely, hugely satisfying.
Many thanks to Tina Roche from the Cambridge Cookery School in Hills Road.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't just said it.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart, and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Flavour, the food and drink programme for Cambridge. And we've time now to catch up upon the morning's Twitter activity. So over to you, Alan.
Yeah, we've had a few tweets in this morning. Pride of place, I think, must go to Jack's Gelato. Yes, Jack's back. He's right now is outside Trumpington Road entrance of Botanic Garden scooping the cold stuff. Inda's Kitchen, they've got a pop-up at the Royal Standard in Mill Road on April the 5th, so you need to book now. Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street off Gwydir Street has tweeted to say they're open till 11 tonight. They've got four cask beers on tap, and Buffalo Joe's will be serving from 6 p.m. Thirsty in Chesterton Road, they've got Buffalo Joe's on Tuesday. And also the Beavertown beer tasting, which I think we talked about last time, is almost sold out. 10 minutes ago, they had two places left, so get onto them quickly if you want to go to that. Six Ice Cream in Bennett Street. Today's flavours include rosemary salted caramel, which sounds rather nice, Matt.
Yes.
You like the sweet stuff, don't you?
I do.
Rhubarb sorbet, which is right up my street, and pink grapefruit sorbet. So they're the latest tweets.
All that on a gorgeous day like today.
I know. Can't wait to get there.
Now, I was out recording sounds in the city recently, and I found an allotment site that I'd never been to before. There were two chicken houses there. My parents used to have chickens, my sister used to have chickens, but that was all a long time ago. But it did remind me, and I thought, wouldn't it be nice to do a feature on allotment chickens?
So you did.
Yeah. Now, this won't be an exhaustive guide of do's and don'ts. It's simply a piece about people who like keeping hens.
It's a lovely sunny morning here in Cambridge. I really enjoy finding these little pockets of silence, the fact that you can have such a busy city, and yet here, merely a few streets from Mill Road, it's perfectly quiet, so serene. This is allotment country.
I'm just going to the chicken run, it's a bit stiff. Oh, there we go. Excuse me, chickens. No, I can't let you out.
Shall I come in?
Yes, why don't you come in? So, I haven't got anything, look at them. So, what we've got is 10 chickens, and we've got three that are the older ones. That one there, which is actually a Cambridge Blue.
Oh, yes.
We called that one overbearing.
That's Debbie Whitfield, allotment member and keen chicken enthusiast.
The speckledy one has got Wenlock, that's right, my daughter named her.
Wenlock.
Wenlock, so if you remember, Wenlock was the mascot for the 2012 Olympics.
Oh, yes.
Yes, so, and she really liked the name, so we've had her since 2012, so she's, well,
4 years old.
Nearly 4 years old.
Yeah.
And the other one is an Arsenal player, I suspect, the white one, I can't remember what she's called.
One of our co-op members is a big Arsenal fan, so we've had lots of them with Arsenal names.
Oh, yeah.
We've had Fabregas, no, Cesc, was it? Danny Welpeck.
All the puns.
All the puns, yeah.
I'm the only one who actually names them and remembers the names. And they're usually all named after Arsenal players.
Barb Gorick, chicken co-op member and staunch Arsenal supporter.
But I ran out of... Arsene Wenger doesn't bloody buy anybody anymore, so I ran out of names. So that's the last Arsenal one we've got.
So I am Colin Wiles, and we're here at the Vinery Road allotments, just off Mill Road, at the Chicken Cooperative, which is run by five households. And we take it in turns to look after the chickens, to clean them out, to collect the eggs. The co-op really started about 6 years ago, and it started with us having two chickens in our garden at home, which proved to be impractical because chickens eat anything that they see
Yes.
and scratch the place to death. So we moved them down to the allotment site and built a purpose-built run, which is here in front of us. Mm. And it has sleeping quarters, a food dispenser.
We've got about three different water containers here, mm-hmm. of which that one over there is obviously the most easily accessible. And they're all changed regularly. It's all clean water. So this one, they're drinking out of this here, an old watering can. Rather than going to the
fancy purpose-made one.
To the fancy, more expensive purpose-made one, but, you know, they'll do that. Sorry, I didn't introduce myself. So my name's Seamus Doherty, and I'm also a member of the chicken cooperative that we have here at Vinery Allotments.
Colin and Seamus have known each other for, did they explain this? They've known each other for about 950 years.
They didn't explain.
I'm exaggerating. They went to university together. So they've known each other for a long time, but yeah. Anyway.
I come from Northern Ireland. My aunt and uncle lived in Donegal, and they had a small holding, sort of a croft, and they used to keep free-range hens there. So I was used at a young age to having hens.
So you've got three or four ex-battery chickens?
Yes, four of them were saved because they weren't needed for the battery farms. Mm. So there's a special rescue place where we go to and bring them back.
But they'd been ordered by an egg producer, 200 or 300... and they'd just cancelled the order, and they'd have been killed.
Blimey.
It's obscene, absolutely obscene.
All that number would have been...
would have just been killed. Mm. They've not even lived a life yet.
Yeah.
So we were prepared to get four older ones, 72 weeks, when they come out of battery hens. But we got these, which are even better, because they're still a rescue, but we've got 15 months more laying out of them.
And they're all the brown ones here, so they're... they're quite characterful, aren't they?
They are, yeah.
Quite stubborn.
That Cambridge blue over there is glorious.
Isn't she gorgeous?
She's so eye-catching.
She's so pretty.
Yeah.
That Cambridge blue, you can sometimes see her riding a bicycle as well, can't you?
Or rowing down the river.
Rowing, that's it. But difficult, you have to adapt the oar so that she can hold it in her wings.
So, so you've got quite an age range in here, really.
Yeah, it's because of losing those seven to the foxes that we had to get new ones quite quickly.
We unfortunately had a fox attack in November 2015. There was a fox forced its way in through a gap in the wire fencing.
And it's like an entire cage, isn't it?
It is, and you have to bury the fencing into the ground. Otherwise, a fox can burrow under it. But unfortunately, the fox forced a gap in the wire and got into the run.
Oh dear, he really had a go then, didn't he?
He really did have a go. Didn't take any of them away. It was quite a scene of carnage. Mm.
That's the second fox attack we had. We had another one 3 or 4 years ago when they took about three. And Patrick, down the end, lost nearly all his hens to some foxes who jumped over the fence. It was about 7 feet high without a cage on top. So they just got over the top and killed them all. Except for one called Margaret, who was then left on her own.
And because they're flock animals, you can't just have one hen. Yes. You know, difficult to talk about psychological damage for a hen, but it's, you know, a hen will suffer if it's not in a flock. So,
well, Margaret, it was funny because there was someone over here in these gardens behind the allotments had a cockerel, and suddenly one day, in Patrick's pen down the end here, this cockerel appeared and it disappeared from here. When Margaret suddenly looked very happy, and this cockerel was, you know, prancing around looking very pleased with itself.
But you're saying with Patrick, those foxes managed to scale a 7-foot fence.
Yeah, someone took a video of it apparently.
Wow. Which is why ours is caged over the top as well.
Yes, yeah.
Well, foxes are brighter than we are, but now we've put this thicker stuff and it goes under the soil, so it's not digging. So you girls have got to keep safe, haven't you?
There's always a pecking order with chickens.
Yeah.
I used to live on a farm in Wales, and it was very distinct, the pecking order. You could tell who the one was most pecked on. But all of this lot look in very good condition. I couldn't easily spot who is the lowest on the pecking order here.
No, it's quite hard. In the past, we've had very dominant chickens, and you could tell instantly that they were at the top of the order, but now it's not so easy to find out. It's only when they get in close interaction with each other you suddenly see one have a go at one of the others, and you realise that that one's more dominant. But I would struggle at the moment to say which one was the top of of the pecking order.
So they're more or less cooperative chickens in a chicken co-op.
In a chicken co-op, absolutely.
So commercial farms will usually keep their chickens for about 12 to 18 months, which is a maximum
production
period. And then after that, they will usually just slaughter them. But there is a charity that will take and rescue hens and will attempt to rehome them.
That's the Cambridgeshire Hen Rescue Service. Their online address is camshenrescue.com.
And the ones that we saved from through the hen rescue service, they're collectively known as the suffragette hens. So they're Sylvia.
Emily Davidson is the woman that threw herself in front of the King's Horse.
Yes. Christabel, Maud, and...
And I can't remember the name of the other suffragette, but she's a Pankhurst as well. So, but they all look the same, so we haven't actually... We don't know which one's which, but... And Ethel. There we go.
They're all very used to being handled?
Particularly the ones that would have been the battery hen. They're the ones that you can actually pick up. So I'll just pick this one up here.
She barely flinched.
Barely flinched, see? So, and actually what I found also with the newer ones is sometimes when you're here cleaning up, they will actually come and stand right by you. Like the other day I was standing and one was standing between my legs.
There was a Desmond Morris programme years ago where he would stand over a chicken and put his hand down in a shadow over the back, and the chicken would naturally just duck down in a submissive stance.
They do.
He could pick up the chicken, lay it on its side, and it would play dead until he walked away, and it would carry on playing dead for a while. I tried that with my chickens. It never worked. They were rubbish.
They do that with the dominant one. If the dominant one comes near, they just stoop down.
The thing is, Matt, the chickens he was using had been to the chicken method acting school.
That is nice, because all of these chickens here will live out their lives quite happily
here
on the allotments.
Yeah. I mean, they're almost like pets.
Yeah.
If only we could remember all their names.
I like the way they've all gone quiet, like they're listening to us right now, talking about them.
Yeah.
And this one here is just, she's almost falling asleep standing up, just loves the sun.
But they do, I've heard, this may not be true, that they can, half of them can go to sleep and half of them stay awake.
Oh, like a dolphin.
Yeah. That's what I've heard. I don't know how, is that true?
Maybe when the chicken is swimming underwater.
Maybe when the chicken's swimming underwater, that's probably...
In the sea.
In the sea.
Sea chickens.
Sea chickens. Oh, I've just got to lie down.
She's the most relaxed chicken ever, Wenlock there. I've got to get a photo of that.
Get a shot.
There. You are very photogenic, you are. I guess there'll be a few occasions where you've had some double yolks.
Yes.
Yeah. Double yolks.
Those are great.
If they're very big, you can bet that there will be a double yolk in there.
We get double yolks.
Yeah.
We do get some double yolks. One of them, obviously I don't know which one it is. We have tried asking them, but they won't tell us. One of them does lay bigger eggs, and those are normally the double yolks. Doesn't happen very often, unfortunately. I don't know. She's one of those. Isn't this exciting? Yay! got a double yolk. And quite often we give them away because we end up with too many.
Yeah.
Now, because most of them are laying, each day you're getting like 7 or 8 probably a day. That's 8 eggs in 1 week.
Yeah.
You know. So lots of cakes, lots of omelettes. Saturday morning, always have a poached egg. But apart from that, we generally give them away. Like, so our neighbours quite like us, really.
I bet they do.
When we sort of say, would you like to come down and see the chicken? They go, maybe not, but have you got any eggs, please?
And the eggs taste absolutely delicious because they get quite a lot of scraps and greens. They get the proper pellets, but they get additional stuff. So they're very, very bright yellow yolks and very tasty.
What's with all the string hanging down from the cage?
Right, now apparently the greens are really good for them.
Yeah.
So when we finish growing our broccoli or sprouts, whatever, we hang it from here. But it's easier if you hang it up, then they can all have a go, otherwise they can't.
That's a good idea.
So that's quite good fun.
Yeah, we hang them up so that they have to jump a bit and get a bit of exercise. So they've had all my cabbages and kale and everything, so...
Is it right to say I can guess their ages by the size of the crests on their heads?
I think that's right, so if they haven't got the comb, it's called...
The comb,
They probably aren't laying, is my understanding, but I might be wrong on that.
Okay.
But it doesn't start growing properly until they're about 20 weeks old or more. So the comb on top of the head and then the wattles at the side in the young chicks is underdeveloped.
And that's something that's much larger in a cockerel as well, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it is. Yeah. Massive.
I guess until the cockerel reaches a certain age and then it's a comb over.
Very good.
Make a noise. Stardom.
Oh, there you go, a pearl white egg.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think these hens have quite a good life. and then we let them out onto this area as well, so they can scratch and peck at grass and do all the things that chickens should do.
It's a hobby for us. We're not necessarily trying to maximise production, and it's about the welfare of the chickens and ensuring they have a decent life, I suppose.
We see this as being very sustainable because we're not having to go to supermarkets to buy eggs. You know, it's a lot of our scraps are coming down here for the chickens to eat. And, you know, the waste goes onto the compost heap and gets recycled back into the soil. There's a couple here having dust baths. So they get down into the soil and start spraying it over themselves.
But it's just fantastic to watch them when they're sort of all snuggling down in there and getting the earth over them. It's just great. And they are just great fun to watch. Oh.
And they're so soft as well.
Yeah.
No, they are great.
They've had their excitement for the day. They can relax now.
Many thanks to Barb, Seamus, Colin and Debbie and all the hens. You do get some cracking good eggs from allotment chickens. When they've got a diet of their supplement feed and all the extra stuff, the veg and being able to root around on the allotments outside of their pen, it's that kind of thing that gives you the real golden yolks. There are other chicken cooperatives around the city. The latest one, I think, is offering places in the Glebe Holbrook Chicken Share Project, although it's only open to plot holders of that allotment site. And finally, there is a page on YouTube. It's called Mill Road TV, and it has a video by Martin Salmon titled Keeping Chickens. Worth a view.
Right. Craft breweries are definitely on the up, and not least in Cambridge. One that's been around for about a year now is Old Friends Brewery. I met co-owner John Cockley recently to talk beer. John, you're brewing with the Old Friends Brewery. What kind of beers are you brewing?
We're making the beer that we like. The first beer we've launched with is a pale ale, very much influenced by the American style of beers. It's very hoppy. It's carbonated, so it kind of sits in the middle ground between a lager and a traditional ale. But yeah, we're looking very much influenced by what's gone on in the States and looking to bring part of that culture over to here to Cambridge.
What attracts you about that style of beer?
I think beer is such a personal thing. There's so much choice out there, especially over the past kind of 5 years here in the UK. It's really exploded as a market. I'd like to think I've tried a fair amount, so hopefully well placed to make a call on what I like and what I don't like. Yeah, for us, pale ales, they're refreshing, but most importantly, they're very, very tasty.
And that's one of the disadvantages with most lagers, isn't it? They are refreshing, but really, they don't have tremendous taste, do they?
There's definitely something to be said for a nice cold lager on a hot day. Like you say, it's very refreshing. But personally, I've always found that I like something with a bit more of taste, and that's what we get from using ported US hops. The pale ale we're brewing at the moment uses Mosaic and Citra hops, which we import, and they just give it that real kind of bang.
Citra's actually quite a popular hop, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's a bit of a contentious issue at the moment, actually, because there is a shortage coming our way soon, and there's a lot of brewers, a lot of big breweries who are quite worried about how they're going to get hold of certain ingredients, especially hops like Citra.
So that's going to force the price of the hops up, I guess.
It's going to do one of two things, really. Force prices up, but I think it's going to mean that craft brewers and smaller brewers like ourselves are going to have to be a bit cleverer and a little bit more innovative. You know, through any kind of hardship, often good things will come. So hopefully you'll see lots of new and interesting styles of beer coming out as ingredients are limited, and it'll force people to try different things.
Yeah, so have you got in mind what you might do if Citra becomes unobtainable?
we're going to keep brewing beer that we like, and we're confident with the quantities that we're working with at the moment. We can get hold of the ingredients we need. Our next beer will be a slightly lighter kind of a session ale, probably a 4% ABV.
Right. What's the pale ale?
The pale ale's 5.5.
Right. So on the strong side.
Yeah, it's on the stronger side. You know, I don't know how many of those you'd have in one afternoon and still be useful. But the session ale will be a little bit lighter. as the name suggests, something that you would you'd have probably more of in one go.
Yeah, and as summer comes on and people want sort of, I suppose, more drinks.
Yes.
Will you make less alcoholic versions still?
Yes, I mean, we. I think the important thing for us at the moment is to establish the beers that we're making. So really, at the moment, we've only been going for a year, and a lot of that time has been experimentation and trial and error. So we've now got to the point where we're very, very happy with the pale ale, and it's been in the shops for only 3 weeks now.
Right, which shops is it in?
It's in Bacchanalia. On Mill Road and on Victoria Road. It's in Rhode Island in Cherry Hinton, and it's being stocked in the Shelford Deli, as well as a couple of the university bars. I think Clare and Downing have had some. There's also been some up in Yorkshire, so which is quite interesting. A crate of the beer has made its way up to Yorkshire, so we're waiting for feedback from our Yorkshiremen.
Right, I would have thought that would be quite a hard market to crack, actually.
Yes,
breweries in Yorkshire.
Indeed, yes, Yorkshiremen know what they like.
When you were doing your trial and error, were you selling the products, or was it a bit too...
No, we had the glorious task of being head tasters, which it's quite good fun. But yeah, it's difficult to be critical of your own product, I guess, because you've put so much time and effort into it. You really have to be objective and put that aside, really. And we did a process of kind of blind tastings and comparing our beer under blind tasting for friends and family to beers that were similar and that we really admired. And that's when we really knew we'd hit upon something with the recipe from those blind tasting sessions.
That's a really good idea. It's a very scientific approach, actually.
Indeed, and quite good fun as well.
I bet you had got a lot of new friends. Have you looked sort of into the future? Where would you like to be in a year or two's time as far as the brewing's concerned?
Yeah, I mean, beer is very much a volume game when it comes to, you know, really making a successful business out of it. I think in the first instance, we're not getting beyond ourselves. We want to make really good beer that we're really proud of and that we would like to drink ourselves. We're getting a real kick out of doing that and out of the feedback we're getting from people. And we're going to keep doing that. Like I say, I think if you're seriously going to launch a large business, it's all about volume. And that would have to be further down the line.
Mm. And are the beers you're brewing, are they only available in the bottle?
Yeah, it's just bottles at the moment. Eventually, we'd love to have things on keg and cask. Obviously, that requires different equipment. And the quantities that we're brewing at the moment, we felt that it was best to get it out to market in bottles. You know, it really is quite an organic process. These bottles are, you know, hand-cleaned, hand-labelled, hand-capped. So it's quite laborious, but you know that what you're buying has had, quite a lot of love gone into it.
Great. Okay, well, good luck with it, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And that was John Cockley from Old Friends Brewery, and I can definitely recommend Old Friends. It's good beer, well worth seeking out, even if you have to go as far as Yorkshire.
That good, eh?
Yes, indeed.
Well, Alice Archer, manager of the Cambridge Wine Merchants on Cherry Hinton Road, is back now with some information on what I suppose is currently considered niche wines.
Yeah, if you're buying organic carrots, then why aren't you buying organic wine as well? I think wine is lagging behind the rest of food. You know, people are concerned about where their muesli has come from, where their carrots have come from. Organic is seen as healthier. So, I've no doubts that it is. I certainly think it's healthier to the world as a whole.
What we're really talking about here today, then, is the way wines are perhaps going to go.
Yes, how these trends are going to be met. And yeah, so the proportion of organic vineyards, I think we're around, so it's something like 8 or 10%, something like that. Mm. And that is definitely growing. In the EU, mm-hmm. organic wine is wine made from grapes grown in accordance with the principles of organic farming. And so this does mean not using artificial or chemical fertilisers, pesticides, fungicides and herbicides. Mm-hmm. Your weed protection is through ploughing or having different cover crops. Nature is not designed for a monoculture. Nature is designed for everything living and thriving together. And the reason you end up with pests is because with demand, you have to increase the size of your vineyards. And this usually means that you're cutting away the grasses, the trees around. You're not intentionally destroying natural habitats of certain animals and insects. And this means that you've lost the predator.
Yes.
There's no predator left, therefore the vines are vulnerable, which is why you need pesticides, why you need herbicides, etc. This is where biodynamic viticulture is actually very interesting. So organic viticulture is simply you don't use these kind of chemicals.
Yes.
There are quite a few people who most of their wines are organic, but they have one biodynamic vineyard that's somewhere off in the mountains or something like that. So I've never been in a biodynamic vineyard, but I'd be very interested too.
Yeah.
If I were to make wine, I'd probably like to make it that way, just for the kind of rhythm of it, if that makes sense. This is because it's a holistic approach. It's all about prevention rather than protection. And it's a lot about the soil as opposed to the vines themselves. It's about having this nutritious earth that is feeding into the vines. It's difficult to describe biodynamic viticulture because when you first describe it, it sounds like you're bonkers. It's all based on some principles that were actually written in the 1920s by Rudolf Steiner. And there were things like burying cow horns full of cow manure. The manure has to come from a female cow that has calved, and then it gets buried in the corner of the vineyard. And so it's a bit like feeding the earth back into the earth. And then once this cow horn's been buried in the vineyard for 8 or 9 months, that's sort of its gestation period there, and then it comes out and they water it down and they spray it on the vines and spray it over the land. It's older than the principles of organics.
Mm.
It's not something really people really think of. They assume that it's this new craziness. I must admit that all the different processes you have to go through, I quite like the kind of ritual of them, you know. Like, that's the one thing about biodynamic viticulture, is it's more a kind of lifestyle as opposed to a set of rules.
Hmm.
This is what we advise. You do what works for you. Some people follow the lunar calendar, and so they'll only pick on certain days. They'll only spray on certain days. So it does sound a bit bonkers, but if it makes good wine and it's good to the earth, then why not? So wine is lagging behind, but I think there is a demand, and I think it's a growing demand. And it also means that in 30, 40 years' time, by supporting these practices, it means there's more likely to be sufficient supply of wine as opposed to these vineyards dying from pesticides. People value the term old vines, but you're not going to end up with wine made from old vines, which tends to be more intense, say. But old vines aren't going to be around if pesticides continue to be used in excess.
And there'll be more on organic and biodynamic wines in a month's time with Alice, because it's an interesting subject with some, well, as you'll find out, some very interesting stories behind it. Time for the food and drink news now, and there's lots of food at the Milton Country Park Fair running today and tomorrow. Food includes Provenance Kitchen, Churros Bar and drinks from Stag's Breath Whiskey. 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. £5 for adults, nothing for children, and free parking.
On Monday at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Mill Road, Spring Into Fizz. They'll be uncorking some of the fizzy stuff, and all you have to do is drink it. Tickets are £15. It starts at 7 p.m.
And at the Cherry Hinton Road branch of Cambridge Wine Merchants, there's a wine tasting called A Tour of France. That's on Wednesday the 6th of April at 7:30. Tickets are £20 from Eventbrite, and you'll find a link on the Cambridge Wine Merchants website.
The Eat Cambridge 2016 Food and Drink Festival brochure is now available online. There are so many good things going on, it's impossible to give a fair synopsis, so this is an unfair one. The big event is happening at the Corn Exchange in Wheeler Street on the 7th of May from 10:30 till 4. £2 for adults, free for children. And there are many stalls there, including Jack's Gelato, Ali's Baltic Bakes, The Allotment Cafe, Culinaris, Kane Smith & Co., Norfolk Saffron, Pinkster Gin, the Rice Boats, Karelian Food. And talks include Rosie Sykes and how pint shops' menus are driven by seasonal produce, and more of that in the next edition of Flavour, by the way.
Other events at the Eat Cambridge include a chef demo and tasting lunch with Mark Poynton at Alimentum in Hills Road. That's on the 8th of May at 12:30. £50 plus an additional £20 if you want the flight of wine to go with it. Also on the 8th, Flavour's Nazima Pathan, her husband Pierre, as well as Stella Pereira and Ozzy Beck will be presenting a food styling and photography workshop. Venue to be announced, £35 per person.
on the 12th of May, East's Shop at Pint Shop in Pease Hill with Rosie Sykes and Andrew Webb. Four courses with drinks. It begins at 6:45 and is £50. Rosie and Pint Shop chefs will prepare the dishes from what's in season in East Anglia, and Andrew will introduce and say a few entertaining things about each one.
On the 13th and 14th of May at The Shack at Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, it's the Gog and Gorilla Kitchen Supper Club. Six courses for £45.
On the 14th of May at Burwash Manor in Barton, it's Asparagus Day. This is free. There are free tastings, cookery demonstrations, tractor rides around the farm, all sorts of things. That's from 10 till 4.
The Food Park Night Market takes place on the 21st of May, 5 till 10 p.m. at Gravel Hill Farm on Maddingley Rise. It's a street food extravaganza. £5 entry, pay as you go for food and drink. It's an extremely popular event and you'll need to book early at foodparkcam.com.
And time for one more. As part of Eat Cambridge, Cambridge wine merchants will be hosting a two-day wine festival on the 21st and 22nd of May in the Cambridge Arts Theatre. That's in St Edward's Passage.
And looking ahead, there's another Cambridge Food and Drinks Festival on the 4th of June. It's run by Thirsty of Chesterton Road and it will take place in the Bodyworks Dance Studios on Glisson Road. Outside will be a street food fair featuring Steak and Honour, Provenance Kitchen and Holy Schnitzels. And inside will be tasting stalls and bars featuring craft beers, wine, spirits and coffee. Live music too. Tickets £15 per session and the sessions run from 11 till 3:30 and 4:30 to 9 p.m. And on that happy note, I think that's all we have time for on this week's Flavour. We'll be back on the 16th of April at noon. And don't forget, you can have a second helping tomorrow morning at 7. And from the Cambridge 105 podcast page or via iTunes early next week.
And following us today at 1 p.m. is Mandy's Garden Shed. At 2, Radio Dante. From 3 till 5, 105 Sport. At 5, Tony Bonfield's Roundabout Cambridge. At 6, Mike Pryor's Soul Show. And at 7, I'm back with Rocklit. And today on Rocklit, Beatles expert Alan Thatcher will be saying goodbye to the Beatles producer George Martin and to Keith Emerson from Emerson, Lake and Palmer, who both died recently. And among the tracks we'll be playing are takes 1 and 7 of the Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever. But until the 16th of April, from me and Matt here on Flavour, goodbye.
Goodbye.